Now it's going. Sorry about that false start.
Okay.
This is an oral history interview with Will Hooker of September 2008 at his office in Kilgore Hall on NCSU campus. I'd like to start off with our standard first question. Tell me a little bit about where you're from.
Well, it's upstate New York, a little town called Williamson, which is east of Rochester, New York, right on Lake Ontario.
How did you get interested in landscape architecture?
I grew up in a small town, like I say, and we were outside of that town. It was kind of a farm belt, fruit belt. And I spent all of the time that I had outside of what I had to do inside out in the woods. So I was interested in nature, interested in the woods, and when it came time for me to go off to college, I said, I want to be a forest ranger. So I looked around and saw that there was a College of Forestry at Syracuse in the State University of New York campus there, and so I went there thinking I'd be a forest ranger.
No kidding.
They happened to have a Department of Landscape Architecture as well. And, you know, through a series of events, I decided that in looking around and not being happy with the curriculum I chose, I dropped out of school for a year, etc. When I had to decide what I did want to study, I realized that one, landscape architecture involved one of my passions and one of my gifts, and that was coming up through secondary school, I was the class artist the whole time. And so landscape architecture involved that, and more importantly, I had, being in the College of Forestry, gotten in a professional fraternity, and the people in the fraternity that laughed the most and had the most fun were the people studying landscape architecture. So I said, I'm going to go study that.
Of course.
So that's what I did.
And so you did your undergrad at SUNY then?
Right.
Well, how did your attention get drawn to North Carolina State?
Oh, I fell in love with a woman from Durham, and turned out I married her and moved down here. That didn't last, but I fell in love with North Carolina. So here I am.
So you graduated from School of Design in 79, right?
Master's degree, right.
Who were some of your teachers?
A whole series of them. Dick Wilkinson was one, Randy Hester, Linda Jewell, Dennis Wood, Bob Stipe was one as well, and some of those sorts of folks.
What kind of projects did you work on?
I worked on a couple projects. I worked on one with Randy, and it was kind of a summer pay thing where we did a study of the town of Edenton. They were trying to upgrade their image. I think they were trying to become more of a tourist destination, so they contracted with Randy, who just previous to that had done a study of Manio and had helped them turn themselves around and become a real entity. So Edenton called on him, and he had some money, and I was one of the grad students he hired. So,
did the Edenton project ever come to fruition?
Well, I don't know what fruition means. We studied, we made recommendations. I'm sure they followed some of those they didn't. So, you know, I don't know what that means, but I think they went forward with some of it.
Well, that's good.
Yeah.
After you got out of school, what did you do?
I didn't learn much when I was taking my master's degree. I didn't learn much that I didn't know, because when I went back for my master's degree, I was already a registered landscape architect. And most folks going to school were going to school to get the skills in the background to go out and become a registered landscape architect. So there wasn't much that I picked up in the university. The main thing I picked up, and in order to go to university, I had to have a job. And I was offered a three-quarter time teaching assistantship, which basically meant I taught all my own courses. I was like a professor, except a very inexpensive one. And so the main thing I learned in my graduate school experience was that I loved to teach, and I was good at it. So immediately when it came time for me to graduate, I started looking for a job and had a series of offers, had three offers, Illinois, San Luis Obispo, and LSU. And then I got a counteroffer from this department, Department of Horticulture, because the guy who was in my position teaching small-scale landscape design had quit unexpectedly at the very end of the year, which was not cool. And so they had to make an emergency appointment. And the students, I had some of the students from here come take some of the courses I was teaching at the time as a grad student in the School of Design. And they recommended me, and one of my committee members, J.C. Ralston, strongly recommended me. So I came here to take a one-year appointment until I found the real job I wanted teaching someplace else. And I've been here 30 years.
Wow. Well, so what year was it that you started?
Started teaching?
Here.
79.
And what was the horticulture department like when you started teaching?
Oh, gosh. In retrospect, I'd have to say it was pretty grim. It was populated by a bunch of good old boys who were part of a good old boy system that I didn't have much use for. And an overwhelming majority of them were, in my mind, not very bright people. I mean, they didn't have kind of a global perspective. They didn't understand the world around them. They didn't understand how to interact with people. They didn't understand politics. They only understood a very narrow scientific discipline with which each of them were concerned, like breeding grapes or post-harvest physiology of an obscure apple. And that's what they knew. And they had come along, to their credit, I guess, or to their luck, at a time when that was enough to get them tenured and advanced in promotion. So, you know, I came in and it was the whole university setting is really, it's more of a game than anything else. And it's a game of figuring out what it is you want to do, where you want to go, and how you can do that. And the university is set up with lots and lots and lots of rules and stumbling blocks and hurdles. And if you can figure out how to play the game, you can wind your way through the maze and do fine. And basically, I understood it was a game. And most of the good old boys around me, they didn't understand that. They thought it was this lockstep didactic sort of process, and this is what you do. And so they were real easy to play. You know, even though I was this bombastic, raw rookie of a professor or instructor, you know, they were just way too easy to talk into doing what I wanted to do. So that's what I did.
And what was it that you wanted to do?
I wanted to do whatever I felt like doing. And that meant, I mean, at the time I was studying magic. How does magic play into the landscape? I was studying earth energies. I was studying dowsing, how to read earth energies running through the landscape. This is way outside the parameters of a typical landscape architectural job, and way outside the parameters of a typical landscape architectural teaching position in any standard school of design. But when I got here, I was the only person in the landscape design option, and it was radically different from the rest of horticulture, which was about growing crops and, you know, how to treat all of that stuff and how to put poison on the land with pesticides and herbicides and stuff. And so they told me, they said, "Will, we don't know what it is you do, so you have to tell us what it is you do, and further, you have to tell us how we should evaluate you." And I said, I can do that. So basically, I could define my job in any way I wanted, and I did. So I could say, okay, I'm going to teach my students Tsazen, and I'm going to take my students on field trips, and we're going to raft down the river because they need to feel that, and all of these things that in fact are true, but within a normal paradigm of teaching landscape design at a university, that doesn't fit. You know, and along that same line, I mean, I started dealing with sustainable landscape design in the late 80s. I mean, it was ecologically based, but I started saying, this is important, and we're going about it wrong. And I started teaching it and learning it and studying it. And, you know, as little as even 5 years ago, I had people walking up and down the hall saying, Will, you're spending too much time teaching about sustainability. Well, now these people are out there in public touting the fact that they've got one of the champions of sustainability in their department, proud of it. Whereas 5 years ago, they were berating me for it. They didn't get it. And now they're saying, well, now we get it. So, okay, thanks.
Well, that is what makes you different from other instructors, isn't it?
Yeah.
Is teaching the sustainability.
That's one of the things, I think, yeah. I mean, that not anymore am I different. Everyone now sees it, so everyone's doing it, but you know, I've been championing that cause for 25 years now, something like that.
What's some other things that make you different from other instructors?
Oh. I'm not afraid to make it quite clear that I came out of the hippie generation. I mean, I was a flower child. And, you know, the peace, love, make love, not war, all of those things I have touted and I have made very clear in all of my interactions the whole time. And a lot of people, because that got mashed so bad at one time, they just hide. You know, they cut their hair, put on the corporate suit, and, you know, pursue the almighty dollar. And that's not what I've done. The other thing that's been kind of fun and has turned into a big deal is, for me, because I tried practicing for a while. In fact, one of the guys I practiced with was one of Lewis Clark's employees and mentees, I guess, proteges, Dick Patton. And we did Bright Leaf Square, and we did some other things together. And I just found that I couldn't practice and teach both, because they're both very high time demand jobs. I couldn't do them both and at the same time do either well as I wanted. So since my main paycheck and my main passion is in teaching, I gave up practice for the most part. I do some jobs, but not many. And so I had to find a creative outlet. So the creative outlet I found was building things with bamboo. And most people just think of bamboo as an invasive exotic, and they need to get rid of it. Well, I see it as a resource and a wonderful material for building sculpture. And because it's free, it's a real good product for me to employ with students, because the university doesn't have much of a budget. So real easy for me to go cut free bamboo.
Well, each year you make a different sculpture in the front of Kilgore Hall. This year, I think you've outdone yourself.
Yeah, it's something, isn't it?
It really is. One of the field trips you sometimes take your students on is to the gardens of Willie York's former residence in Raleigh. And Lewis Clark designed the gardens. What do you want your students to see when they go there?
Well, I don't go there anymore, of course, as you know. That's been developed, and it's got apartments and stuff there. The thing that I used to like about going to that garden is, one, I liked how the home was settled into the landscape. That was really nice. And I liked how it took water at the introduction to the estate. and there was some sort of a water feature right there. And that water started dribbling, and it dribbled down, and it went past the bonsai garden, and it went kind of under the house, and then it went through the landscape and dropped down and went under the road and dropped into a hole and went into one of my favorite parts of that landscape. It was on this nice lake, but it had down below where the pool was, it had what was known as a wine cave, where Willie York kept his wine in bottles set in kind of a stone trough, at the back of which came the water that started at the front. It dropped into that trough, and then when that overflowed, it dropped into a very shallow pond where other things were stored in crock pots, and it went out and dropped into the lake. So what Willie York would do is he would go down there, and Lewis designed all of this, I'm told. He would go down there, and he would, and there were these big, four big blocks of stone set in the middle of the pond where the water overflowed from the wine trough. And he'd go down, and he'd take a stone, and he'd knock on those, and these big carp would come out of the lake, because they knew Willie was going to give them food. So he played this little game with the carp, or whatever the big fish was that came up, catfish, I don't know what it was. And it was real nice. Now, of course, to me, this was one of my favorite mysterious spots in Raleigh, because the estate was abandoned, and I knew how to get there, and I knew where to park. And so I would go late at night with friends or with a date when I was single, and go down into that cave with a candle and a bottle of wine and hang out. We'd knock on the rock. The carp didn't come anymore because it was long gone. And I'd take my students there just to show them. I said, don't be afraid of opening your eyes. So that was pretty nice.
How has your program changed over the years?
Well, a big change was early in my career. I had been teaching about 2 years, and the program was essentially the same size. We have maintained between 95 and, say, 110 students the entire time I've been here. And this is with ups and downs in population, in the rest of the undergraduate population in horticulture, and in the populations across the nation in horticulture departments. We've stayed steady. And I think the reason for that is that our program is unique for a landscape design option in horticulture. Most programs across the country have a landscape design option. What they're trying to do is teach the people who are going through that program to go out and become contractors. Contractors who will build what other designers, landscape architects often, will design. When I got here and looked at the program, they had one design course. They didn't even have a planting design course. And they had something else. So they had like 6 credit hours, 2 courses worth of stuff. And to me, that wasn't enough. So I rewrote the curriculum, and I included a design studio, a planting design course, and a graphics course in it, in addition to an introductory design course. And so I upped the design component of the curriculum and made it very strong. In fact, I required 2 studios, one of which the students had to take over in the College of Design for many, many years. Well, the other thing that happened is I realized one person could not handle 95 students. And even with help from J.C. Ralston and some of these other people in advising, it was too much. And so I decided that I was not going to work as hard as I was working. I was working 80 to 90 hours a week the first 2 years. And I said, this is not what I want in my life. And so we had a faculty retreat, and I stood up and I told them. I said, here's what we have. We're the biggest undergraduate contingent. And I said, I'm the fourth instructor you've had in this position. And I went through them. I said, this person started, he worked 2 years and quit. This person started, he worked 2 years and quit. This person followed him, he worked 2 years and quit. I said, I've been here 2 years, and tell you what, I'm quitting. And I said, you guys get your act together. If you want this program, you need to support it. You need to get more people in here teaching. And if you don't want it, drop it, because you're going to keep doing what I'm doing, quitting. And so they panicked. I said, give him another guy. So they immediately found the money to hire another position. And that's the position that Tracy Traylor came into. And she and I worked together for 20 years. And we were a really good combination. We just complemented each other in a very nice way. She did the planting design. I'm not great with plants. I'm like most landscape architects. I'm not great with plants. And here I am, a professor in horticulture. Seems ironic. It is. Tracy was great at that. And then there was some money that came along that was intended to hire a minority position someplace in Cal's. And they offered it to Tracy and I. And we said, yeah, we'll take it. So we looked around, and it took us a year. And they kept saying, come on, hire someone. No, we're going to look around. And we finally hired a guy, came in, Amici Akibo. He did a great job and worked through. He actually got tenured. He was on a tenure track, got himself tenured, and then had a little bit of a falling out with the department, because Amici was an artist and the department didn't. And furthermore, he was an African. He operated on African time, not this kind of good old boy up and at him being at 7 a.m. so you can, you know, beat the crowd or whatever. Amici showed up when it was time, and they didn't get it. So he left. He's now a tenured professor teaching up at Cornell in their landscape architecture program. Mm. And a very well-renowned painter down in New York City all the time in the galleries. So basically we had three positions with Amici, and then Amici left. And they were kind of waffling, are we going to hire someone? And then Tracy retired. She kind of got a degree in economics, so had figured out a portfolio and all that stuff. And she had more than enough money, and she didn't need to put up with what goes on in the university. So she retired. So basically, there's no one here except me again. So the administration opted that they would rehire the planting design position, and we had two people apply, and they were both good, and one was energetic and dynamic, and the other was so subdued. And the energetic, dynamic person I wanted, because she had a lot going. The other person, you know, the undergraduate coordinator wanted, because he's a guy who doesn't like strong women. He likes a woman he can control. And the other woman was subdued, so he liked her. And so we had a battle, and I won that battle. The department opted to hire the energetic woman. And so the department head and the undergraduate coordinator got together and talked the administration into hiring the other woman as well. So we're back to three positions. And that's fine with me, but it's been a struggle. And now we're going through change again, because the woman that I advocated for has decided she doesn't want to go for tenure here. She's got some struggles relative to dotting I's and crossing T's, basically. And so she's leaving. She'll leave at the end of this year. And the other woman is up for tenure. We'll likely get tenure, but we're going to need another position. And then right now, I'm looking at retiring myself. So the whole thing's going to be up in the air again. But change happens.
Sure it does. Do you see a conflict today between landscape designers and landscape architects?
In my mind, no. That doesn't mean there's not a conflict. Now, interestingly enough, I graduated here from the School of Design and moved cross campus to another college, another building, College of Agriculture, Department of Horticulture. But the people that I had gone through school to get my MLA were still over in the College of Design when I came. And when I rewrote the curriculum, I tied the courses together, I mean the two departments together. Our students had to take 15 credit hours from landscape architecture. And so they allowed their students to come over here, take the design studio, the planting design course we taught, the courses JC taught, our plant ID courses. So it was a very mutually beneficial setup. And in that it was so tied together and synergistic, it was unique in all the nation. Because it was landscape design and landscape architecture working together as well they should. Because basically, landscape design is just the smallest scale that landscape architecture functions at, typically residential work. But not different in any way other than scale. A landscape architect is trained to be able to work at a wide range of scales, including regional planning, town planning, campus planning, major developments, all the way down to residential design. That all worked great until, basically, the bottom line is a bunch of Harvard graduates got into the College of Design. And I'm not a fan of what Harvard does to people. It tends to turn their heads so that the only thing that matters is that they win, or that, you know, that somehow they have to be in competition as opposed to working together. And enough Harvard graduates filtered into the College of Design, including the dean, that eventually they hired a woman, and this was in 2000, to be the department head for landscape architecture, and she was a Nazi. And she decided she didn't want to have an association with landscape design. So 20 years of cooperation that had gone out into the field, all across the state, people had worked together, been in classes together. A lot of my designers who got out and either do design and build or build what landscape architects design worked together, great. She unilaterally terminated that and cut it off. So again, we were in the same situation that most other programs, our universities around the nation that have two programs together, we were in competition. And it was really a sad thing. And finally, the College of Design realized their mistake in hiring this woman because she didn't get along with anyone. And she wanted to be an administrator. They gave the job to someone else and she left. And now they've rehired, so we're working our relationship back. Out in the field, and this is intriguing. I don't know how many years it was ago, maybe 10. The landscape architects in North Carolina decided that they needed to be not just a name act. Prior to that, from about 1973 on, you had to pass an exam in order to call yourself a landscape architect. But what you did, there wasn't anything. It wasn't a practice act at the time. Well, they put a practice act into effect about 10 years ago, and at the time, they tried to make all practice of landscape design having to be registered by a landscape architect. Well, Tracy and I went down there and said, no. So we've been teaching here 20 years. We've got 20 years worth of students out there doing residential design. And I said, some of the residential lots are greater than the 1 acre that you're trying to write into law. They're in these big developments, they're 2 to 10 acres, they're still residential design. So we will not allow you to do that, and we will fight you if you try to make that part of the practice act. And it was interesting because I was in a number of meetings and some of the people said, we don't want to have to compete with you. I said, are you afraid of competition from better designers? said, and of course they couldn't say yes. In fact, they were. And basically the Practice Act got written. So anything over 1 acre in size that is designed by a landscape designer has to be a registered landscape architect, with the exception of residential work. Now, we can't do multifamily. That's because that's outside of single family residential. So, and most landscape architects don't even know that that's the exception. They treat it as if it's everything. And I have to remind them, and they don't like being reminded. So I don't know what's going on. I found it intriguing that at one point, and this was back, oh gosh, this was back about 1990, sometime in there, that some of the people who were grading and passing or failing the people trying to become registered landscape architects noticed this interesting trend that students that had come out of this program and gone on to go in the landscape architect's office, they had, at the time, they had to do this program plus 4 years of apprenticeship. At the time, folks coming out of an accredited landscape architecture program had to do the degree plus 1 year. And what they noticed is that the students that came out of this program passed probably 4-1 in relationship to the students coming out of that program. Mm. And they said, "What's going on here, Will?" I said, "We teach them, you know, and we do. We're very kind of hands-on, nuts and bolts. Here's what you do. Here's how you do it. Then you will evolve and figure out where it's going." And over there it was kind of ephemeral, pie in the sky crap that, you know, they come out not knowing how to do anything. What's happening, and I credited it at the time, I said, the reason our students are passing, they got the same basic fundamental education as those students, not as much on design, but fundamental. The reason they're passing is they had to work 3 more years in an office. And then in when they did the Practice Act, the engineers were trying to steal work from landscape architects. And they've got it so it's ridiculous. Now, if you get out of that program, you need 4 years before you can sit for the test. Come out of this program, they need 8 years practicing before they can sit for the test.
Well, I didn't realize it had changed like that.
Mm-hmm.
Goodness gracious. How would you say your approach to teaching design has changed over the years? Or has it?
Well, obviously it's changed. I used to do more detail, more nuts and bolts. I kind of found a rhythm that works for me and for the students. And I found this about 15 years ago, and I've kind of stuck with that. And basically what it is I recall when I was in school, both as an undergraduate and as a graduate student, we would wallow in our projects. We had one project for a whole semester, or one project to two projects a semester. And I remember I was teaching a studio one summer, and I had a student that I knew struggled making decisions. So I decided he wasn't going to have time to struggle. So I cranked up the time frame and cut it down to the point where he only had 3 or 4 days to do a whole design. And of course, in summer school, it's very intense and very compressed and everything. But I said, you know, that worked, and it worked great for him, and it worked great for everyone else. And so I basically introduced that type of a intensity into my normal semester studios. And I still use it. And then recently, and I did this once years ago, probably 20 some odd years ago. Now I do it, and starting about 2 years ago, I've started to do it every semester. And what I do is I have what is known as Blitz Week. And where typically students now get 2 weeks to do a project, which is a lot, because they have to go out, they have to survey the lot, they have to get all the data from GIS and everything like that. They have to interview the clients, they have to measure the house inside and out, measure the lot, take the topographic information, and then they have to do the design. And I require master plan, axonometric drawing, a couple of sections, and some perspectives. And that's all within 2 weeks. In Blitz Week, we do one project a day for a week. And all the same stuff. They have to go to survey, take the data, make a base map, get the information, do the design, draw the axon. They have to do... So basically, they don't sleep for about a week. And it's a blitz.
Sounds like it.
And what they realize... Now, it's not sustainable. I know that. And one of the big changes is I'm teaching more and more and more about sustainability in my courses. But one of the things they realize is that if they stop kind of wallowing and just do it, they can do it. And further, their designs are just as good, if not better, than when they... And basically what it comes down to is during their wallowing, they're not working. Well, you know, I'm a taskmaster. I make students, if they're going to survive in UACall, you have to do work. You have to work like hell. And so during Blitz Week, I mean, they basically give up everything and just do this. And they come out of it, and it usually takes them about a week to recover their sleep. But they come out realizing that they're not limited by time. And so that's a real good gig. And when you get out in the profession, if you're doing this, you know, it's like one of my students went this past summer. In fact, he's a teaching assistant now. He went to work for a landscape architect. And he said the whole summer was Blitz Week. Well, oh.
So you introduced the real world into your curriculum.
Precisely.
Which one of your projects... And this can be ones that you worked on with Dick Patton, or just ones that you've done on your own, or that you've assigned. But which one of your projects do you think says the most about you?
I would say my home landscape is the one that does that, because that's what my wife and I are trying to do. Is we are trying to establish a model of sustainability that anyone can follow. And further, what the most recent thing I'm doing, and I'm working on this, and you know, fundraising, which I've never done, and all this stuff, I'm going to put up a website that is basically going to be a year in the life of sort of thing, with monthly videos by very talented and renowned videographer and a good writer-producer. And we're going to have not long but short clips there, and there's going to be a blog associated with it, and all of this where anyone can tune into that website and figure out how to take on this aspect of sustainability or that. So basically, and we're using our home as that landscape. So probably that says as much about who and what I'm about as anything. I'd say one of the things that certainly Brightleaf Square said a lot about how I approach corporate design. I thought Dick Patton and I did a great job on that, and it's since been completely wiped out and redone. I've not been over there. But the other project is this thing out front now. When I do sculpture, and this I think needs to be part and parcel of every design, every landscape design. One, as an artist, I'm not into angst, and I'm not into making people cry or angry or whatever. I'm into beauty, and I'm into joy. And so what I want people to do when they interact with anything that I've built, and I can make this the foundation of my sculpture, is I want them to smile or chuckle or laugh out loud, and I want them to be to interact with it in order to get it. And so the piece out in front of Kilgore, or that gazing ball and bamboo thing I did for the museum several years ago, they say a lot about, you know, what I believe. So their projects.
What's the one important thing to know about Will Hooker?
That's a good question. I guess that my everything I do is based on essentially a spiritual foundation with the earth. I mean, the earth is part of the divine, and in a sense, you know, I'm what you might call a shaman or a shaman of, and not a shaman really, more of a caretaker of the earth. It's my job, a disciple of the earth, to take care of the earth. I had a spiritual teacher one time who told me, she said, "Will, at one time in your past, you were married to the earth in an obscure ceremony." And I can only picture that. And she said, "You're going to be reincarnated again and again and again, and you're going to keep coming back. You're not on one of these get off the reincarnation wheel things where you go off to heaven or go off to nirvana or whatever." She said, "You're here. Just accept it." And, you know, when I think about it, living on this earth is not easy. There's a lot of pain involved, a lot of hard decisions. But it's really what I want to do. I want to keep living on this earth. So I want to keep being reincarnated and coming back and figuring out another way to take care of the health of the earth. I guess that's kind of bottom line. And then the other thing is, the only way I know to do it, at least in this incarnation, is passionately. Just gotta go for it.
So we need to know that Will Hooker is a passionate person.
That's right.
Well, Will, that's all the questions I have for today. Do you have anything that you'd like to add?
No, I guess the only thing, I thought it would be more about Lewis and what Lewis is about. And my sense, I didn't know Lewis when he was a landscape, when he was teaching, but I knew a bunch of people who went through and learned from him. And I didn't really know much about him when he was practicing. You know, I got to know him really through you when you were hanging out with him. And he became a good friend. Lewis, the thing I like about Lewis as a landscape architect is he takes his inspiration for what he did from the same place I do, and that's from the earth. I mean, he looks at, and I remember him explaining this to someone sometime, and I had known it, but I didn't know that that's where he came from. And he said, if you look at a plumbing system for a city, a sanitary sewer, he said, or even the water, he said, it's structured the same way a river is structured. It's got different orders of magnitude, and there are X number, and it can only be X number because that's the maximum that can be handled. And he said, you can think about it the same exact way. If you look at the river system and you look at the sanitary sewer system, they're the same. And so you take your inspiration from nature. And I like that. I like that a lot about what, where he was coming from, because obviously it did run a chord with me.
What's one important thing that we should know about Lewis Clark, then, from what you understand about his work?
I think also that he's very passionate about what he does, yeah, or what he was doing. I would guess he's still passionate about what he does.
He's painting.
I bet he's doing passionate painting.
He is. Well, that really is all the questions I have.
Okay, cool.
Great. We'll end it with that.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you.